You are tuned to the Nighttime Podcast, focused on the fringe of Canada.
I've always been grateful for the story ideas I receive from listeners of the show. Looking back at my prior episodes, nearly 40% started with a listener suggestion, and I still have an endless archive to work my way through. Now, aside from the sheer number of recommendations, I'm constantly impressed with their variety. To give an example of the range, in the last 2 months, I've received both a request to profile a famous racehorse and an invitation to interview a 6-year-old child whose parents insist she's frequently abducted by aliens. Tonight's topic was one of the first recommendations I received after inviting listener requests on one of the early episodes of Nighttime, but it wasn't just a single request. For a few weeks in late 2015, I received almost daily messages about this case. The reason for the frequency was simply a matter of timing. As it turned out, just days after I first requested story ideas, a seemingly random stabbing occurred within Toronto's financial district in the middle of the day and within the aisles of Shoppers Drug Mart, a well-known Canadian drugstore. Although a city the size of Toronto is no stranger to murder and mayhem, this attack was entirely unique. In the days after the attack, while the victim was barely clinging to life, the city was captivated by the manhunt for a beautiful, well-dressed woman security footage captured fleeing the store just after the attack. In tonight's episode, we'll hear the bizarre story of Rohini Baisasar and the unprovoked murder she's accused of. Back in December of 2015, when word spread of a stabbing in a Shoppers Drug Mart within Toronto's financial district, Canadians were surprised by the brazen nature of the attack, but many felt comfort in their suspicion that the incident was related to some type of personal feud between two financial sector employees. When police shared more details, interest in the stabbing escalated to the point of becoming a leading story. Initially, the details were sparse, and with every update, the story became increasingly bizarre. For many following the case, the full extent of the crime would be learned 4 months after the murder when an article titled What Happened to Rohini Baisasar was published through the well-known lifestyle magazine Toronto Life. In this article, Toronto-based freelance journalist Razel Robin provided the results of her investigation into the accused Rohini Baisasar's life. The end result was an in-depth, thorough telling of a story as bizarre as it is tragic. When I began planning this episode, my first step was reaching out to Razel and asking her to get involved. To my surprise and my delight, she agreed. I'm honored to include some short excerpts of my recent conversation with Razel in this episode. Rather than me telling you more about her, she can introduce herself now.
My name's Razel Robin. I live in Toronto, Ontario, and I started writing probably 20 years ago now as a magazine writer. And I worked for Canadian Business Magazine and some other magazines, and then eventually left to have some kids and started up freelancing in probably 2013. And then had always kind of wanted to write about a crime story or just do some crime reporting. And then I really got my chance when this one came along. So I heard about it just like everybody else did, really, in Toronto over the news. And this would have been December 2015. Basically, Rohini Baisasar was wanted by police in connection with the murder of Rosemary Junior, and they had released a bunch of photos of Rohini to the public, trying to find her. They were trying to locate her. So I saw her photo on TV. I watched the story unfolding, and I knew people in the Bay Street community. And so I started talking to them, and it wasn't long before I found people who knew her, who had seen her in the bars and restaurants, and people who had networked with her. So it was fairly easy to find people fairly quickly who would talk to me about her.
With the introductions behind us, we can now begin the strange story of Rohini Baisasar. The episode will be divided into two sections. Our narrative initially will begin by following the victim of this crime, Rosemary Junior. In telling the story of Rohini and the crime she's been accused of, it's important to know that Rosemary Juniper appears to be a completely innocent victim who had done nothing to increase her chances of becoming a victim to a violent crime.
Rosemary was a young woman, probably late 20s. She was just married. She was beautiful, stylish. She liked to have her hair and nails done just right. She was a perfectionist. She worked at a private medical clinic called MedCan here in Toronto. It's in the downtown core. A lot of finance types go there to get their arteries scanned or, you know, health checkups, whatever you can get with all the bells and whistles there. She was an ultrasound technician there, and she was a coordinator at the clinic. And she was the only person qualified to run this particular machine that would scan the carotid artery for signs of plaque buildup. And she had recently been promoted. So really, she was a successful young woman at the prime of her life.
On December 11th, 2015, Rosemary's day was shaping up to be unremarkable in nearly every aspect. Were it not for what would happen to her that afternoon, this day would simply blend in with any other day of the week she spent tying up loose ends and anxiously awaiting the upcoming holiday.
Yeah, she had a kind of a slow day at the clinic. She helped a couple clients and did some paperwork in the morning, and she babysat for a client who couldn't find childcare, and then she took off for lunch, and it was interesting. Her colleagues said that usually she sat at her desk for lunch, but for some reason this day, I guess it was a slow day and it was before Christmas. Maybe she wanted to get some shopping done. So she left and went down to the PATH system to a Shoppers Drug Mart.
Just after 2:30 p.m., Rosemary had a pause in activity at the office and decided to take a short break and visit a Shoppers Drug Mart store in the shopping concourse below her building. With that unremarkable mission in mind, Rosemary boarded the elevator and began her descent into the underground city below Toronto, called the PATH system.
Toronto's PATH system is basically a network of tunnels filled with shops and salons and food courts. It's just like a big underground mall. It's right beneath the financial district downtown.
Although the PATH system stretches on for more than 30 kilometers, this particular portion of the underground network is situated below Toronto's most densely built-up area, the financial district. As this area is home to many of Canada's largest financial institutions, the foot traffic in the area is simply breathtaking. Myself, not being from Toronto, I asked Razel to describe what the scene in the PATH would have been as Rosemary made her way through the busy tunnels into the Shoppers Drug Mart.
It was a Friday, mid-afternoon, December 11th, so this would have been a really busy day down there. Tons of people coming and going, rushing around, some people leaving work early as it was a Friday and maybe getting some Christmas shopping done. It would have definitely been a busy scene. And lots of, you know, it's a well-heeled crowd, a well-dressed crowd. People are all sort of in the finance community around there.
After making her way through the hurried swarms of briefcase-carrying people, at about 10 minutes to 3, Rosemary Juniper entered the comparatively slower-paced environment found in a Shoppers Drug Mart. As you'll hear Razel describe, what should have been a forgettable moment in the store would instead change the lives of everyone connected to this story.
Like, Rosemary's colleagues, as I mentioned, were perplexed about why she went to that drugstore. There was a closer drugstore. They were all trying to make sense of why this happened to her. We'll never know why she went to that drugstore, probably. Rosemary entered the store just before 3 p.m. She was talking on the phone. She was talking to a friend of hers, congratulating that friend for getting a new job. She was perusing an aisle when, out of nowhere, seemingly, she was stabbed near the neck. And it was just one wound, but it was life-threatening. Her friend on the phone says that she heard Rosemary screaming and said, "I've been stabbed, help me." And presumably people rushed to her defense or to help her. And then she was taken to hospital.
With the staff and other shoppers in the store in a state of shock, at 2:55 p.m., the 911 call was made reporting a woman stabbed and bleeding profusely in the drugstore. Despite only one stab wound, the knife did considerable damage, and Rosemary, in critical condition, was rushed to St. Michael's Hospital to be placed on life support. Almost as soon as the news spread of the attack, it was reported that the attack may be random in nature, and the police were on the hunt for a petite woman that the store's security cameras captured fleeing while Rosemary screamed for her life.
The surveillance photo showed a small woman, petite woman, well-dressed in a business suit, a skirt, and a blazer with, I think, a pink blouse. And she was known in the Bay Street business community. People identified her pretty quickly.
As the image from the surveillance footage began circulating, a name would very quickly be connected to the petite, well-dressed woman. On December 14th, just 3 days after the stabbing, Toronto police requested the public's help in locating a 40-year-old with connections to the financial sector named Rohini Baisasar.
I don't have the details of the police work that identified her. All I know is what the police told the public, which is that they were searching for Rohini. And when I wrote the story, it was all pre-trial. It's still pre-trial. The police wouldn't talk. Any witnesses in the store wouldn't talk. And, you know, for good reason, because it can jeopardize her trial. So, yeah, all I know is that there was an image released to the public, and that image, that person was identified as Rohini Baisasar, and they wanted her in connection with the stabbing of Rosemary Junor.
As Rohini's name and photographs spread through the press, news consumers were stunned by the story, and for a variety of reasons. The well-known location, the rumored randomness of the attack, and of course, Rohini's photo. Turns out she looks much more like a model than a murderer. This interest in the case quickly led to people all over Toronto assisting the police manhunt by keeping an eye out for Rohini. Although the details of how she was apprehended have not yet been publicly released, Rohini managed to avoid capture only one day after being named a suspect in this attack. On December 16th, just after 3 p.m., Rohini was arrested, initially facing attempted murder charges. Now, at this point in the story, despite the news of the attack and Rohini's arrest getting considerable attention, the motive behind the attack and the character of Rohini was still a mystery to those following the story. The first glimpse of how bizarre this case was about to become came in the form of an email. Just 10 minutes prior to Rohini's arrest, an email pleading for help was sent from her email account to the major Canadian newspaper, the National Post. The upcoming reading will include a portion of the message thought to be sent from Rohini just minutes before her arrest. It opens with a plea.
Do you know any top professionals in artificial intelligence, biotechnology, nanotechnology, satellites? Maybe military, maybe government. Something has been happening to me, and this is not my normal self. I would like to know who and why this is happening. There is either a single person or more responsible, and who and why would be nice to know. I'm sorry about the incidents. I felt the need to be extreme to see if it would work. I would normally not do such a thing.
As you heard me mention previously, Rohini's arrest was originally on charges of attempted murder, as Rosemary was still clinging to life. Sadly, that changed on December 17th, 6 days after the attack, and the day after Rohini's arrest. Rosemary would now succumb to her injuries, and as such, the charges against Rohini would now be upgraded to murder. The following clip is a portion of CTV's widely shared coverage of Mrs. Junor's funeral.
To the hundreds of mourners who came to pay their last respects, Rosemary Junor was known simply as Kim. The 28-year-old lost her life in an unprovoked random attack, a stabbing in the PATH system that left her family searching for answers.
How can you come to terms with something so horrible that has happened here?
I don't know what to say. I can't explain. I'm sorry.
What was most difficult about this day was the proximity to happiness. Junor got married just months ago. Those who celebrated with her then returned to reflect on her life.
I remember seeing the two of them really happy, dancing. So beautiful.
As the hearse arrived, it was Junor's husband who now had the task of ushering his wife's casket past the threshold of her childhood church.
She never had a bad bone in her body. She never had anything bad to say about anybody. That's how I wanted to be remembered.
Thank you. In the weeks and months after Rohini's arrest, the media would provide occasional updates on the case, often adding new pieces of information on Rohini's strange story. But as I mentioned in the introduction to this episode, in April of 2016, 4 months after the attack, our guest Razel published the results of her investigation into Rohini's life in the now widely shared Toronto Life article, What Happened to Rohini Baisasar. During my talk with Razel, I asked her what she was able to learn about Rohini's childhood.
Her childhood was very tricky to report. Her family refused to talk to the media, and for good reason. I went to her old school, her high school. I searched yearbooks. I looked online. I looked at just did whatever I could. And it was interesting to me and kind of sad to see that she wasn't in any clubs or on any sports teams, in any photos I could see. She didn't appear in any pictures, like, you know, kids palling around in the hallway or whatever, yearbook pictures. There was just nothing I could find. I searched probably 3 yearbooks in which she was in, and I couldn't find any pictures of her aside from the graduating picture for that year. I took down the names of some teachers and some classmates, and after a really exhaustive search, I got in touch with only one person who would actually talk to me, and she said she barely remembered Rohini. That was kind of a sad end, and it was looking like a dead end for me as a reporter, I guess. Until I heard from someone, he couldn't tell me much about her anyway, but he did point to a source who he said was a very good person to tell me all about, you know, the last 10 years, Rohini's last 10 years, and that was her ex-boyfriend. It was difficult to get in touch with him. The media were hounding him as well. And then, you know, finally, I managed to get in touch with him, and he agreed to speak to me. And I called him Jeffrey in the article because he didn't want to have his name published. But he told me all about their time together. That, to me, was more credible than the information I got from him about her childhood, because he had told me about these stories, and then the person who had told me to talk to him said that this person, and who was close to Rohini, said this person was very, very credible as a, you know, good source of information about her life. So having said all that, her childhood, I wouldn't say it was happy by the sound of things, but that's a difficult, that's my own opinion just from what I've heard. She worked a lot in her parents' store. She went to school and was encouraged to get good marks, and she didn't have many friends or much of a social life from what I heard and understood. And she was just kind of a good student and a good kid and did what she was told and came from a fairly strict household, from what I can tell. And then, according to her ex, apparently she ran away around age 14. It seems like she was rebelling a bit at that point. And then when she was brought back to her house, the story she told Jeffrey, and he said that she was really upset about it, and she repeated the story many times over their relationship, so he believed it. And he said that she was put through some sort of folk healing ritual, you know, to cleanse her. You know, who knows why, but, you know, if she was dealing with a mental illness, it could have been that her parents didn't understand and were, you know, just trying to do whatever they could to help her. And so, you know, she was put through this cleansing ritual, apparently had some chicken blood poured on her. And he says that she it was a very disturbing incident for her and something that sort of set her mind against her parents or made her rebel more against her parents, I guess.
When Rohini was first named as a suspect in the stabbing of Rosemary Junior, it was said she had connections to Toronto's financial sector. As Razel learned, her connections with the financial world began years prior to the attack she's accused of.
So she started out at York University as a computer programmer. She was completing her MBA while she worked there, and she wanted to get into the financial community. Once she completed her MBA, she just started peppering firms with her resume and just worked really, really hard networking and tried to find a job.
After landing a job and beginning a career with many ups and downs, Rohini would arrive at her last stable job in the financial sector with a company called GMP. She started with them in 2010, 5 years prior to the attack in Shoppers Drug Mart. some of the interpersonal issues and private thoughts she had during this time in the job may be perceived as symptoms of an ongoing mental health issue.
GMP is a really well-known firm on Bay Street dealing with mining stocks. So it was a good job for her to get, and it was a junior job. It was very junior. They're not, they're not high ballers yet. And so she was working under an analyst with three other junior analysts. And from what I understand, in that community, it's very clear that if you're junior, you do what you're told, you do your time, and then hopefully you can show your talents, and you'll get promoted at some point in the future. But from the people who she worked with who spoke to me said that she was very ambitious, which is a great quality, but she was highly, highly critical openly of her analyst that she worked under, and that's really not done. It's like being openly critical of your boss in any situation is just a bad idea generally, and she didn't seem to get that. You know, she seemed to continually criticize her boss and also her colleagues. She said that the men that she worked next to were juvenile, and that may be the case. It probably is the case. And Jeffrey said, like, she would come home really upset about, how she couldn't concentrate because these guys were always cracking jokes with each other and they were talking too loud. And, she seems very fragile, is how somebody who worked with her there said. She just couldn't seem to take that usual banter and of an office environment, especially in the financial district. It can be kind of like a fraternity, I guess, and she couldn't really take it. So, and at the same time, she was going home and telling Jeffrey stuff that sounded to him like increasingly paranoid, but he didn't really know how to deal with it, and he didn't recognize it as, a mental illness or any kind of paranoia at the time. And she was wondering if nanotechnology can control people's thoughts. And but when he asked her, whose thoughts are you talking about? Are you thinking this is happening to you? She wouldn't answer him. She was just sort of talking in theory about this and wondering about it. And he just thought it was really odd. He just kind of chalked it up to stress. And it's difficult to see when you really love someone, you care about someone, you've been in a relationship, and they start changing. It's pretty subtle, I think. He said she was definitely starting to spiral, though, like the stress of her GMP job and, the noise of her office environment was getting to her. So I think she lost that job about like less than a year after she got it.
After Rohini lost her job at GMP, the downward spiral she was on brought her deeper into dysfunction. With the loss of this employment, Rohini would begin looking for a new role in the financial sector. It's at this point in her life she would become consumed by an obsessive, disorganized, and frantic job search.
She started looking for another job, and her job search became, from what he was describing, Jeffrey described it as a very frenzied, focused job search. Like, she would spend hours and hours and all night looking for work, filling out application forms online, and she would ask him to fill out application forms while she was filling out application forms so she could get more application forms filled out. The job hunt became an all-consuming job on its own. And at the same time, she began craving isolation and asking, Jeffrey to. It started with, if he would tidy up. Their apartment got really, really, really messy. He said it looked like a hoarder's basement in there, and he would try to tidy up, and she would tell him to stop because it was too distracting for her. So fruit peels would pile up, and, he said it was just disgusting. He just tried to spend as much time out of the apartment as he could, and that was easy to do because he had just gotten a good job, again, entry level, so he wasn't making a ton of money, and by this time she was out of work. So the two of them, were never working at the same time, and also, he did feel a certain obligation toward her, even though, she was becoming more difficult to live with and more difficult to be in a relationship with, I would imagine. He felt, a real commitment to her because she had supported him all those years when he was a student and when he was kind of lost and floating around and everything and trying to find his way. She told him to, get his act together, whatever. And she supported him for years financially and in every way. So he really felt committed to her. And so while she was craving this isolation, for me, this detail, I'll never forget it. It was heartbreaking. Like, he went out to Home Depot and bought material to make a cubicle for her. So he effectively built an office for her, like a room that she could have in the apartment so she wouldn't be distracted. And I just thought that right there showed his devotion to her and his love for her. So it must have been a real tragedy to watch her spiraling out.
In fall of 2013, 2 years prior to the attack, Rohini would experience a major life change and shortly after would have what is thought to be her first interaction with mental health treatment. The life change would be brought about by Rohini's disorganized state becoming too much for her live-in boyfriend, who we are calling Jeffrey. When the pair split up, Rohini would return to a place she was said to be less than comfortable, her parents' home. The details of what actually occurred are foggy, but some type of violent incident while in the home with her parents would lead to Rohini being placed into treatment.
This was an outburst that had happened in her home, and like an incident where she damaged a door in her home occurred, and because of that incident, she was taken into, she was put into treatment in a mental health facility.
Although the details surrounding the incident and the damaged door are still the source of speculation, whatever happened was significant enough to land Rohini in treatment. If we're questioning if Rohini suffers a mental health problem, her now ex-boyfriend, Jeffrey, is said to have noticed a tremendous difference in Rohini's behavior while at the hospital and under the care of physicians.
According to Jeffrey, he said that she greatly improved with treatment. He said he could finally have a conversation with her that made sense. It was like a long time since he'd had a conversation with her. He said that so she wasn't like trying to, you know, get him to fill out application forms or whatever. She wasn't saying things that sounded to him like they were paranoid. And, you know, they had a very real moment. And I think he said it was really a big eye-opener and obviously made a huge impact on him, that he thought, well, it could have been like this for a much longer time, and, oh, this is what was going on with her. Finally, he had some answers. So, you know, that was a touching scene that he described to me, I think, when he just laid down with her and held her hand and felt really close to her while she was in the hospital, you know, receiving treatment.
After receiving mental health treatment, Rohini's life found its way back on track, and she even landed a job in line with her professional training. Sadly, Rohini's time receiving treatment was brief, and for reasons all her own, she decided to discontinue the medication. Not surprisingly, as the treatment ended, her symptoms returned, and again Rohini's life spiraled back into one consumed by an obsession with a disorganized job search. But unlike prior to her treatment, this time, she wouldn't have the shelter of Jeffrey's homemade cubicle to contain her all-consuming mission and would wind up homeless for all intents and purposes.
Based on conversations that I've had with, you know, people who were in the Bay Street community and would see her, she was basically wandering around in the financial district homeless, and nobody figured it out. Except there was so she would go to a gym where she had a membership. I'm not sure who had bought her the membership or if it was just something she had from, you know, that hadn't expired yet or whatever, but she still had a membership at a gym, and she wouldn't go there to work out, but she would go there to sometimes nap and shower and maybe be on her laptop, and she would go to a Starbucks and hang out there, but only order hot water for the whole day. She'd sit there with hot water. And she would try to talk to men who looked like they were in positions of power, women who looked like they were in positions of power, people she could network with, people who were, you know, well-dressed in suits and ties. She was just sort of trying to give her resume and trying to find some job still. Her job search was, as I mentioned, all-consuming at this point. And of course, I mean, that does make sense whether she's mentally ill or not. It makes sense because if you need a place to live and you need a job, you're going to, you know, if you're homeless, especially, and you have an MBA and you're trying to find work, well, you're going to do everything you can to find it. So But yeah, she was seen in restaurants and cafes and gyms, in a gym in the financial district, and just moving from one place to the next with and being homeless.
Despite living in the state of homelessness you just heard Raisel describe, Rohini was able to maintain the appearance one would expect from a member of Toronto's financial community. Countless people have come forward as interacting with Rohini during this period and having no idea the state she was living in. In fact, in my March 2018 Nighttime Talks episode, Christy Lee of the Canadian True Crime Podcast shared some details of her encounter with Rohini during this time. But for those who know Rohini, a sign that things weren't well with her came in the form of a strange email she sent to a list of acquaintances. In the next clip, I'll share a reading of an email Rohini sent in March of 2015, 9 months prior to the attack on Mrs. Juner. This message, in which Rohini requests donations to fund her job search, was sent while she was living in the homeless state Raisel just described.
I have utilized all my funds pursuing my dream job and now need help to continue in that pursuit. I'm trying a new approach to fund that pursuit. I'm asking all my friends to contribute if they can and wish to. Denominations of 1, 2, 5, 10, 20, 50, or $100. I suggest such figures as I know that the Royal Canadian Mint produces currencies in such denominations. Hence, it will be an easy contribution. Anything less than $1 might not allow me to achieve my goals in a timely fashion. My goal is to simply ensure I have basic necessities. Food, water, shelter, clothing, and products for hygiene and beauty, while I continue to secure an appropriate role in an appropriate organization, firm, or entity. Thank you kindly for considering providing help such that I continue to pursue my ideal job. I look forward to hearing from you soon.
In the months leading up to the attack at the Shoppers Drug Mart, Rohini was living the strange life you heard described. Homeless, bouncing between fitness center bathrooms, local cafes, and the subway stations that connect the PASS system, all the while in a disorganized state, burdened by an obsessive search for employment in Toronto's financial industry. It's at this point in the timeline of Rohini's life that we get to the violent, unprovoked attack on Mrs. Juner that led to the name Rohini Bisesar becoming well known in Toronto, and for a terrible reason. The following clip from Global News will give a glimpse of how this story in the search for Rohini was first communicated to the people of Toronto.
At around 3 Friday afternoon, a woman in her late 20s is shopping inside this drugstore in Toronto's underground concourse when, according to police, a complete stranger allegedly walks up to her and stabs her, and now she's fighting for her life in hospital.
Based on what I've seen from the images and what I know from the detectives, a completely unprovoked attack on an unsuspecting woman, piercing a vital organ where that woman remains in grave condition.
Police say this is a random attack and are looking for this woman, 40-year-old Rohini Bisesar, wanted for attempted murder. Andres Pone knows her. They both went to the Schulich School of Business where she received her MBA.
She's a very gentle individual, a very calm individual, despite what has been alleged. What has been alleged is extremely, with a capital E, out of character for her.
Police say Bisesar is not known to them, but say she is considered violent and dangerous.
Physically, she's tiny. She might be 5'1" in heels, and I'd be exaggerating if I said she weighed 90 pounds. She's a highly educated person. She's a professional career woman. She's, sophisticated individual. I don't know what has happened.
Investigators are urging Bisesar to turn herself in.
At this point in the narrative, we're largely caught up to present day. However, Rohini's story is still unfolding behind a courtroom's closed doors. As there's presently a ban on reporting specific details of the legal case against Rohini, I'll wait until this process runs its course, and at a later date, produce a follow-up episode. What I can tell you at this time is that the activity thus far in Rohini's murder trial has been just as strange as you might expect. The trial, so far, has been spent addressing Rohini's mental fitness and has been interrupted by Rohini's rambling outbursts. During the proceedings, Rohini has made requests to have a metal detector brought to the courtroom to prove there is some kind of controlling device implanted in her body. She's fired multiple lawyers. She's complained of the voices in her head distracting her from the judge's instructions. She's arrived at court with extreme bruising on her face. And perhaps most troublingly, she has on several occasions seemed to not believe anyone was even killed in the incident. Now at this point, it's important to know that Rohini has yet to be found guilty of any crime. However, it's my opinion that regardless of what verdict is found, when all is said and done, this case will not see justice, at least not in the traditional sense. Before we conclude this episode, I wanted to share some additional portions of my discussion with Raisel. As you heard her explain prior, her investigation into Rohini's life and the crime she's been charged with have been incredibly thorough. But during this investigation, she didn't only speak with those who knew Rohini. She met with Rohini in prison. I asked her to describe how that came to happen and what it was like to sit across the table from an incarcerated Rohini.
I went to meet her just in the hopes that she would meet with me. And it's interesting because in that prison, you can go and do that, and that should be the way it is. You know, you can just walk in and you have to, you know, arrange the appointment the day before or something. But then if the prisoner wants to see you, they can just come and see you. And if they don't, they don't come and see you. So I said my name and who I was and mentioned what I was doing. And I told her everything, what I was, you know, what the article was about, and just telling her story. And I told her some things that I had learned, and whether I wanted to ask, give her the opportunity to confirm or deny some of those facts. And I didn't think that would really jeopardize her trial at all if she just confirmed, you know, I went to this school and I, you know, those sorts of things. But she just was very, very cautious about what she could say and what she wanted to say. So she really didn't say much. I mean, we sat there for about 45 minutes together. She came in, she's very tiny, and she didn't look as presentable as she did, well, I guess, when she was in the photos, the mugshots and the photos that you see in the media that were released. She looked like a woman in jail. She did not look, you know, her best. She had sort of hair that was, I guess, fairly unkempt, and she was wearing just a green prison-issue sweatshirt. She was very small, and she had maybe what looked like some scars on her face or some injuries on her face, and it wasn't clear what was going on there. She didn't talk about them. And she just kind of, I guess, we just sat there, and I tried to get her to talk about, just to confirm a few facts that I had found, and she just kept repeating that she has to get advice from her lawyer. And I said, okay, and she could leave at any time, and she chose not to. So my feeling there was that she just wanted some company and she wanted an ally. And yeah, that was about it for our meeting.
After hearing that Raisel connected with Rohini in this way, I asked if they'd been in contact since. As you'll hear her explain, they were, when Rohini phoned her long after that first meeting.
When I was reporting the story, I left my phone number so that she could call me from prison if she wanted to change her mind and, you know, confirm some things or tell me anything. And this was also at the time, like, she had fired her lawyer eventually, and she kept cycling through things. Like, so I thought it was probably fair for me to get that phone number to her, and she could have, you know, an outlet anytime she wanted it. In any case, she never did contact me until well after the article was published, probably 6 months or a year. It was probably a year afterwards. And I think it was by the time that she received a treatment at a mental health facility that she was able to contact me. And that's only my assumption because she wouldn't tell me where she was, but she was able to make a phone call. And you know, and when she made the phone call, it wasn't collect. It was just a straight up call. And usually if they're calling from prison, it's always collect, right? So I assume that she was not in prison at that point, that she was probably in another facility. But Yeah. So, and it was around the time when she was being ordered for treatment. So she just wanted to make contact and really tell the story the way she sees it. And I can't really tell you, I don't really feel comfortable giving any information about what she said exactly, because anything can affect her trial.
Given the amount of work and research Raisel has done during her reporting of Rohini's case, I asked her if she had any plan to continue pursuing the story in the future, perhaps writing a book.
I had a couple of talks with some agents about writing a book, but we just didn't see it going anywhere, especially since there's no trial yet. And I don't think I'll write a book about it. It's so sad, It's sad because there's no closure for either side. It's not like there's really a clear-cut good guy, bad guy kind of thing. Everyone's just, if it is a case of mental illness, and I can't speculate, but all I can say is that it seems to be a tragedy all around.
I want to thank Raisel Robin for being so generous with her time and sharing her amazing reporting with the listeners of this show. Raisel is such a positive example of a professional journalist. Simply speaking with her and viewing the art of reporting through her viewpoint has taught me a tremendous amount that I'll apply to future episodes of this show. Thank you for that, Raisel. And to any loved ones of Miss Bicesar or Mrs. Juner, I want to offer my sincerest condolences for the unimaginable situation you're in. I hope this episode was respectful to you and to your loved ones. If you feel like contacting me and sharing your story, I'd be happy to hear from you. And with that, we'll conclude this episode of Nighttime. I want to thank the ambient pop duo Paragon Cause for providing the music for this and many other Nighttime episodes. You can check them out at nighttimepodcast.com/ParagonCause. If you're interested in hearing more content, please check out the Nighttime Patreon group, where for $1 a month, you can support the show and access supporter-exclusive bonus content, such as exclusive videos, bonus audio, and prior episodes that are no longer available on this main feed. You can join by visiting patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. I'd like to specifically thank the current patrons of the show and the newest members of the group for making it possible. Megan, Chuck, Joanne, Donna, Casey, Abby, Howard, Jennifer, Darla, Deb, Claire, Karen, Francis, Juliet, and the great guys at the Generation Y podcast. I sincerely appreciate your support of Nighttime, and thanks for becoming patrons last month. For anyone else out there who'd like to support the show but can't financially, you can help by telling your friends about me and leaving a positive review on Apple Podcasts or equivalent. And if any of you listening want to stay up to date with my activities, both on and off the show, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I use the handle @NighttimePod. If you have any story ideas or some feedback for the show, I'd love to hear from you at nighttimepodcast@gmail.com. So until next time, keep looking around and let me know if you see anything weird.
The Nighttime Podcast is written, hosted, and produced by Jordan Bonaparte. Copyright Jordan Bonaparte.